Bring in your trash, you might give it some cash. Talking about cash for clunkers. It's not really that good for the environment.
It's In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. A good thing Congress had time to re-up cash for clunkers before getting out of town, man. That's important. I was worried I wouldn't be able to watch other people buy new cars. And here's the crazy thing. This really struck me. Now that scientists have gotten a chance to examine this program in action and run a few numbers, the benefit of getting all those clunkers off the road is kind of underwhelming. In the best possible scenario, maybe you saw this, the environmental impact of cash for clunkers could be the equivalent of stopping carbon emissions in the U.S. for 3 hours a year. 3 hours a year. Now, that's not nothing. But it does make you wonder if there might have been higher impact things we might have done with all this money. Let's just call this what it is, right? We're stimulating the auto industry. Okay, including a lot of foreign companies that make very fuel-efficient cars. But it's kind of sad, you have to admit, to think about a perfectly decent clunker. The car that I drive might be what we consider a clunker. I think it's on the line. That might have gone at a discount to, say, a poor family. Thinking about that car being hopelessly disabled, as required by law, with sodium silicate, apparently the magic substance of car death. That whole thing just gives you a lot to think about, competing priorities and competing interests. Instead of thinking about, health reform, right? Yesterday's news. Anyway, a chunk of the blame or the credit, depending on how you feel about the whole thing, for pushing off health insurance legislation into September or never, maybe, I don't know, goes to this group of legislators called the Blue Dogs. I'm sure you've heard a lot about them. Fiscally conservative Democrats. They're on the fence about this whole thing because, among other things, might cost, $1 trillion, maybe more. It's a lot of money. All the talk about this one group, the Blue Dogs, got me thinking about just how many subgroups like that there are inside Congress, in the House especially. And all these little clubs and coalitions and caucuses can be really important to how things play out. So we called up Molly Hooper. She covers the House of Representatives for the newspaper The Hill. See if we can get just a little brush up here. Molly, thanks very much for coming on the show.
Hey, no problem.
So we'll start with the Blue Dogs since they're getting so much attention right now. Remind me quickly, who are these guys and women, if there are any women, and where did that name come from?
Oh, yes, they're women. In fact, the chairman of the Blue Dogs, a 52-member group, is a woman, Stephanie Herseth Sandland.
Mm-hmm.
These are more conservative members from the South, fiscally conservative especially. They tend to be middle-of-the-road, pro-gun, and many of them are pro-life.
Are there a lot of new ones in the House this latest term?
Well, actually, it's kind of funny because Blue Dogs limit the number of members that they have.
Really?
Unlike other caucuses in the House, there can only be a certain number of members in the Blue Dog Coalition.
They limit it to 52?
That's an interesting number. Exactly. I know, exactly. But I would say there's only about 5 or 6 new members.
So it's a competitive kind of thing. You can't just declare yourself a Blue Dog and start coming to the meetings.
Exactly.
Wow, okay.
If you are chosen by the Blue Dog Coalition to be a member, they will put a lot of money behind you in a race.
Putting aside healthcare, how big a role have the Blue Dogs played in shaping the rest of President Obama's agenda on the Hill so far?
Actually, they haven't been throwing their weight around as much as they could have. For instance, on the economic stimulus bill, the Blue Dogs, their big, big thing is economic fiscal soundness. But for the most part, the caucus or the coalition voted with the Democrats.
So maybe they've been saving some of their clout, their political capital for dealing with Obama and the more liberal Democrats, maybe for something like the health care.
Exactly. And that's what people have been saying up here. But here comes the rub, because not only do you have the Blue Dogs, you also have the Congressional Progressive Caucus, the liberal left-wing MoveOn.org type folks. I think they have 77 members total. And they are gung-ho public option people. But they haven't really been involved in the negotiations. Primarily, the Democratic leaders and Obama have been talking to the Blue Dogs.
Well, taking the progressives for granted, you might say?
Exactly.
That they'll stick with Obama no matter what.
The progressives sent a letter to Nancy Pelosi saying, don't take us for granted here. You know, unless there is a robust public option, you aren't necessarily going to get our vote.
you've got, I guess, the Congressional Black and Hispanic caucuses mm-hmm. qualify as groups. Those are self-explanatory.
Exactly.
Something called the New Democrat Coalition that yes. I don't think I've ever heard of. Who are they?
Basically, they're pro-business, more conservative fiscally. Mm-hmm. And I would say, and this is just me, it seems like members who weren't necessarily accepted to be in the Blue Dog,
uh-huh.
they tend to be members of the New Democrat Coalition.
So are they a factor in the healthcare overhaul?
Oh, yes.
They are, okay.
Don't you love this? It's great. The New Dems are, like I said, more pro-business, pro-small business. They want to make sure that the small businesses won't be adversely affected by the tax issues that are going to hit when this bill goes into effect. So that's kind of what they're looking out for.
So what does it mean exactly to be a member of one of these coalitions or caucuses? I mean, they have meetings, I presume.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say a weekly basis. Hmm. But basically, you kind of show that you have some influence. People are more likely to court you because they know that you're part of a larger group. As well as, you know, when the members get together, it's easier for them to know that they have support if they're going to be taking a certain position on something.
If you got to go against your party, it gives you a little bit of cover.
Exactly.
Do you formally, like, sign a piece of paper to join one of these coalitions?
It's very formal in that you have to pay dues.
These are sounding more like fraternities all the time.
Do you want to know something?
Yeah.
It kind of is.
You got to pay dues. They're
yep.
selective.
Exactly.
There are ones that spring up for the people who don't get into the really popular ones.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes.
So what are the important subgroups that you would highlight for us on the Republican side?
The most important one these days is the Republican Study Committee. And that is made up of over 100 Republicans. So that's more than half of their entire conference. They are conservative, conservative, conservative.
And they're very committed to their studies,
apparently. Oh, they're committed to those studies.
What kind of a name is that? What are they studying?
Good question. I don't know. They're studying what they're supposed to be for and against, and who knows?
Any other Republican groups really worth knowing about right now?
Well, the Tuesday group. Those are the moderates. Keep in mind that because Republicans lost a lot of seats, that caucus in particular took a big hit. And so now they have about 30 members.
I think the Republicans need to work on the names.
Exactly.
I mean, they could both stand to work on the names of these groups a little bit, but
exactly.
the Tuesday group, because what, they meet on Tuesdays or something, right?
Yeah, but this is the best part. They actually used to meet on Wednesdays. It's great. It's like my mom is in a tuna group, right? Well,
okay.
It's actually a bridge group, but they all eat tuna fish sandwiches. You know, I mean, they're random. They have these random names.
Well, that's cute for your mom, but this is more important stuff we're talking about, isn't it? Well, Molly, it's been fun to talk with you. I hope we'll do it again.
Oh, no problem. Thank you. I appreciate it. It was fun.
That is Molly Hooper. She covers the House of Representatives for The Hill newspaper. And I'm just realizing now, about, what, 8 minutes into the podcast, that I have a particularly rustly shirt on today. I'm sorry about that. I have to remember not to wear rustly shirts on podcast day. And for now, I'll try to just keep my neck very still. The biggest news of the past few days, it's fair to say, nobody really saw coming. Almost nobody. Paula Abdul is not coming back to American Idol. No, of course, I'm talking about a much cooler story. A top secret mission to free hostages from a reclusive dictator. A mission carried out by a one-of-a-kind man with charisma, swagger, and a global reputation for all kinds of things, right? I was thinking about how to mark this rather remarkable event. And ultimately, one song in particular came to mind, right at the intersection, this perfect intersection of James Bond, Tom Jones, and Bill Clinton. The theme from Thunderball.
He walks where other men can't walk. He acts while other men just talk. Personal choice of Kim Jong-il. Touching down, he's thunk a bear. He always gets what he comes for. got the night over Al Gore. Helpless as he bends you to his will. No, no one works like Thunder Bill. Any women he wants, he'll get. How can they ever pay him back?
Say, does anyone else here feel like they could use a cigarette? I'm just kidding. Lighten up.
So step aboard his private plane. What a ride home with Hillary B. Quite the same. Is he in it for the glory or the thrill? Probably both. Thunder Bear.
Shredded my voice on that last note, which I checked after the fact. It's a B flat up there, not a note I am naturally meant to hit. And for Tom Jones, too, he's teetering on the edge with that one, but it's a classic, that B-flat at the end of Thunderball. One of the cool things about that song, when I started digging into it, was that some of the lyrics written about James Bond, of course, I didn't even have to change. He acts while other men just talk. That was in the original Thunderball and in this version as well. And the best, any woman he wants, he'll get. All I got to do is make that plural. And it works in this case as well. Video of that song, as often is the case with our songs, which I'm not sure whether to be embarrassed about, because I do not look in any way, shape, or form cool while singing this song. Anyway, we've got the video of the recording of it up on our website, intheloopshow.net, and of course on loopfacebook.net, our Facebook outpost. Now, this song and this whole episode are a nice segue into a bigger question, which is, what is with these Americans wandering across dangerous borders? Like, borders of places that you should know the borders are there, because these are places you do not want to catch you. Sandin, what's with that?
It's like they're playing the world's most dangerous game of hokey pokey, and they just really want to stick their left foot in and shake it all about.
And of course, we don't know what the circumstances were of these individual incursions.
Right.
And of course, it's disputed whether the incursions actually even happened, whether these people crossed the borders. But anyway, Sandin Totten, our producer here, thanks for coming by. And you have been thinking about this question, particularly in the case of these three young people who now are being held in Iran. They were vacationing, sightseeing in Iraq. And
right.
So the first question that comes up is, people are vacationing in Iraq?
Right. It kind of blew my mind, too. I was thinking, you know, who would go there for a summer vacation?
Uh-huh.
And it's not easy to do, right? First of all, there's no direct flights from the U.S. You pretty much have to fly into Syria or Turkey and then take a bus from there. You know, that could cost you a couple $1,000s just to get the tickets. And then getting a visa, it's not so easy to do, except maybe in Kurdistan. And once you're actually in Iraq, you're pretty much going to want a driver and translator just to be safe. So it's kind of a pain in the butt.
I would think so. But people are doing it.
Yeah. I mean, my first thought is crazy people.
Uh-huh.
But then I talked to Tina Townsend-Greaves. She works for this company, Hinterland Travel, based out of the UK, and they actually take people to Iraq all the time.
It depends what your idea of crazy is. I mean, there are some people who would say you were crazy to go on holiday to somewhere with a crowded beach and loads of tourists. And I think for people who want to go somewhere a bit different, who want to see culture, who want to see history, and who want to see behind the headlines, then it's a great place to go.
So there's not like huge crowds of people trying to get into Iraq. You know, they've only taken about 50 people in the last 2 years.
For travel agency?
Right.
Yeah.
But she says that for those who want to go, there's a lot to see.
Oh, gosh. People have been visiting Iraq for thousands of years. It's the cradle of civilization. I mean, you've got Babylon, which everybody has heard of, places like the alleged site of the Garden of Eden. It's a fantastic place to visit.
Wait, the Garden of Eden is in Iraq?
One of the places is alleged to be at the meeting of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. That is allegedly where the Garden of Eden was.
I guess that's a pretty important thing to see if you could see it.
Well, there is a rather large tree there, but I'm not sure it quite dates back to biblical times.
An apple tree?
No, don't think it is.
Okay. So an Iraqi vacation, it's like a little bit of archaeology, a little bit of adventure. It kind of sounds like the perfect vacation if you're Indiana Jones.
Right, with a bulletproof vest and like a bomb helmet or something.
Like a Kevlar jacket.
Yeah, it's still pretty dangerous in lots of parts of Iraq, I would think.
Right, which is why most people go to Kurdistan. They stick to the northern part of the country.
Yeah, a little safer, I guess.
Right.
And that is where these three people were when they were sightseeing and veered across the border. What do people go to see in Kurdistan?
The scenery. Kurdistan is known to be really beautiful. It's got these rolling hills. The area they were in was a spot called Ahmed Awa, and it's known for these, you know, having these high waterfalls and all these areas for families to go and have picnics, you know.
Like Iraqi people too?
Yeah, it's a really popular spot for the Kurds to go in the spring and the fall, you know, just sort of taking the scenery.
Yeah, but it's right, you showed me this on a map, it is right sticking out, this little finger of Iraq that sticks out into Iran.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of Iran border there.
All three sides.
And you would think people would know where that is.
Well, I talked to this one guy, Tyler Wagner, who actually spent his vacation there in Ahmed Awa in 2005. I asked him if accidentally stumbling into Iran is an easy mistake to make.
I mean, I don't want to cast aspersions on another character, but it seems like quite a foolish thing to do. You could certainly do it if you set out to hike in that area. There's no clear line. And if you chose to go away from people who know where the line is, then I'm sure you could cross it. It's just from one mountain to the next. You go down a valley, you go, you know, go into a canyon, you come up the other side, and you're in Iran. I don't know where these hikers were, but one of the areas that I was frequently in around Ahmed Awa, you could see the Iranian border. You were on one mountain, there was a Kurdish Peshmerga, and on the other mountain there were Iranian soldiers.
So it was obvious to you, do not cross.
Even if I were to try to do so, a number of the Kurds would have tried to stop me. So I don't think it would have been an easy mistake for me. But I also never made the choice to go hiking into the wilderness alone.
Well, serendipitously enough, as a matter of fact, as we are sitting here, Sandon, somebody forwarded to us something that had just been published, an account from the fourth hiker who stayed behind.
He had a cold.
He had a cold.
Yeah.
The guy's name is Sean McFessel. There's a name for you. Who confirms some of this. He says the group was operating without a map, that they had no intention of steering into Iran. Here's right. How he writes it. I am absolutely certain that they had no knowledge of their proximity to the Iranian border, or they would never have continued in that direction. I hope people understand my friend's presence in the area for what it was, a simple and very regrettable mistake.
Right. Oh. And as Tyler points out, it's a mistake you can make if you're, you know, not there with somebody who knows the area really well.
So after hearing all this and talking with these other folks you talked with, is this a vacation you think you would like to take?
You know, I wouldn't have thought so, but then I saw the pictures that people had posted from Iraq, and, you know, the idea of being somewhere where there's no tourist traps kind of appealed to me. But mostly, I think it would be really awesome to just, you know, one day show up on Facebook with a status update that says, Sandon's on vacation, ... in Iraq.
Well, you got some vacation time coming up, and I know you have those thousands of dollars sitting around.
Right.
You, so it takes exactly. You to get there. So, Sandon Totten, thanks for doing a little bit of voyeuristic desktop Iraqi tourism here for us.
No problem, Jeff.
Little music from the Smarts here, kind of cleanse the palate. TheSmartsBand.com is where you can learn a little bit more about the band. And as our final act here on this episode of the podcast, I'm going to bring you the second in what is now officially, I guess, because this is the second one, a series here on In the Loop, where I set out to actually meet people who have friended me on Facebook, who I don't actually know otherwise. Since I guess we can now inaugurate this as a little series, we'll call it My Facebook Friends. And like so many things here on In the Loop, it thus deserves its own tiny reverby theme song.
My Facebook Friends.
featuring, of course, a major ninth chord and a bunch of guys who sound suspiciously like me. So, for today, my Facebook friend is a young woman named Hal Bischel. I met her at a coffee shop near the University of Minnesota. She's going to graduate after one more semester. And I use that phrase, young woman, with great care here, because there was a moment in this interview early on when I realized I am not a young man. See, Hal's very into Star Trek. Her Facebook profile picture is her in a Star Trek uniform. And I was just trying to bond a little over what I thought was a shared childhood experience.
There are 5 Star Trek series for those who are, like, unfamiliar with the nerdness.
Really have no idea what's going on.
Yeah. And of all those 5, I really think the best storytelling characterization is definitely Next Generation and Deep Space Nine. So...
is that just because that's the one that you and I in our generation grew up with? Because I remember watching Star Trek Next Generation. It seems like it was on every day when I came home from school.
Do you know how old I am?
Well, you're probably a little younger than I am, aren't you? How old are you?
I'm 23 years old.
So did I just date myself by saying I grew up with Star Trek The Next Generation? That's funny. That makes me kind of old, doesn't it?
I remember being aware of my parents watching it when I was like 4.
Oh, no. There was just something very shocking about realizing that growing up with Star Trek The Next Generation now can make you the old guy at the table. We talked quite a bit about Star Trek, as you might imagine, and World of Warcraft, as a matter of fact, most of which I'm not going to share with you. But here is a little bit longer segment of the interview with Hal Bischel that begins with Star Trek and finds its way to some place very personal and introspective for Hal that I certainly hadn't known about or expected.
A good way to draw a similarity is if you think of someone who's really into Tolkien and the reasons they might be. Tolkien wasn't really an author so much as he was a world creator. And Star Trek is a very similar, very in-depth world that is very appealing for sort of fantasy escape.
Is there something, some lessons that you take from Star Trek that you think could help guide your life?
There are certainly different values that are associated with Star Trek, like the appreciation of diversity and sort of patience with other people's cultures and ways of thinking and the importance of diplomacy and things like that. I suppose I take a lot of that from it, but also, honestly, it's just interesting to me. I'm one of those people who absorbs, like, random pointless facts like a sponge, and so Star Trek is just perfect for that.
So what else would you want people to know about you?
I'm surprised you didn't ask me about my status.
Oh, your status. Your relationship status?
No.
What's
that? You know how when you log into Facebook, it says, what are you doing right now? And you type in your status, and then, you know,
oh, yes.
your friends' feeds, and it's similar to Twitter.
Oh, thanks for, jogging my memory. You're awesome.
Yes, I am awesome.
You're still.
Thank you for reminding. Yes.
That's right. It always says, Hal Bischel is awesome today, or still awesome today.
No, yeah, well, I joined Facebook in the beta. I think it started in 2004, but I joined in 2005, back when you needed a university email to join. Wow. And at the time, I thought that the concept of having a status to change was just ridiculous. So I wrote, Hal is awesome. And then every couple days after that, I wrote, Hal, it's still awesome. And 4 years later, I'm still doing that. Every day or two, I change it to the same thing.
You had never changed your Facebook status since 2005.
Yes, that's correct. Well, no, I change it every other day, but I change it to the same thing.
Right.
And there have been some philosophical discussion under the comment section of my status about how if you're constantly awesome, then being awesome isn't a big deal anymore. So So I should aim for being better than awesome.
Where do you go from there?
I don't know.
Why did you pick blue for the streak in your hair?
It's my favorite color. It's been there since 2000.
You've had a blue streak in your hair for 9 years.
Yes, I have.
Wow. Another very impressive run.
Thank you. I'm a huge fan of consistency.
Do you have other routines that have lasted years that you stick to like that?
Yes. I suppose it's most apparent on my live journal or my website or things like that. And I just have to always have everything the same. It's like a compulsion.
Not in a clinical sense, I don't gather, but just comfort routines.
Yeah. I think probably so much of my life was chaotic for so long that I take comfort in really trivial things being consistent.
What was so chaotic, if I might ask?
I had what I, since I've come to the university and sought counseling and stuff, what has been described to me as an abusive childhood. And I'm never too sure how to frame this to people when I first tell them, because it's information that will make people uncomfortable really quickly. My mother kicked me out when I was 19. And I haven't spoken to her since. There was just this very, I believe the term is walking on eggshells feel. And you never knew if tomorrow was going to be the same as today emotionally. And it was just a very chaotic way to grow up. And so it's very weird being an adult in your own right and kind of being responsible for your own consistency when it was never a part of your life before. And so it doesn't really surprise me that these little quirks have manifested in this way, that these obsessive little bits of consistency for really trivial stuff. It's to the point where, like, it can be something as simple as a grammar error, to be honest with you. I am very particular about using correct grammar in writing anything online, and so if I write something in my blog and I realize like 4 hours later that a certain sentence has the wrong word order, I will go back and change it. Just out of, because it will bother me and bother me and bother me until I do.
And you think you trace that back to your childhood, maybe even?
I'm pretty sure that's how it happened. When I was smaller with my toys, I was always a big on, like, they always had to be arranged in the same perfect pattern all the time. And now it's similar with stuff I published online.
But that gives you a place where you really have total control over.
Yeah, it's very therapeutic in a weird way.
The internet gives you a place where you can be awesome every day. It's up to you.
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah.
All right, a portion there of my conversation with my Facebook friend, Hal Bischel. Hal, thanks very much for letting me come meet you and ask you a bunch of probing questions, and thanks for friending me in the first place. So I thought a nice way to end the show, because we like to feature listener-written poetry on In the Loop here, right, would be to feature a little poem of Hal's, because she is an English major, which means she's super excited about jumping out into this economy of ours. But she does have a number of poems under her belt, and I asked if she could recite one from memory, and she said yes. How about my zombie poem? Which she wrote, she tells me, in iambic septameter, which means, I hope I'm getting this right, stress on every other syllable, 7 syllables per line. So here you go, Hal Bischel's zombie poem. It's very short. Listen carefully. Go.
Fast they raise their weary heads from their cold eternal beds. Worms and fungi soon lament where their midnight suppers went.
Iambic septameter in action. If you've got a poem in that or any other meter that you want to send to us, particularly if it's about the news, which is for the most part what we do, we have got a link up on our main webpage at intheloopshow.net. Oh, and I got one more thing I want to do here before I end. I'm going to tease Hal just a little bit here, but I think she could take it. It's all in good fun. As I was getting up to leave the table from our interview, we were saying our goodbyes, and Hal says, you know, you're shorter than I thought you would be. Okay, fair enough. I'm of below average height, let's just say. And my response, thinking quick, was, well, I must have a tall voice. And I think I said it just like that, too, to really help it sink in. Anyway, that came up. I think Hal actually might have brought it up on our Facebook page a couple days later. And I thought, well, let's just have a little contest on Facebook and see, and spur of the moment, who can be the first to guess how tall I actually am. And the contest was open only to people, Facebook fans of our show, who have not actually met me or seen me. And the winner, after votes rolled in everywhere between, I'm looking at it right now, 5'2" and 5'10.5". To be 5'10.5". But in fact, the winner, largely through process of elimination here, but he was quick, he was paying attention on Facebook in that moment, Jason Mock. And since I'm not friends with Jason, actually, I don't know much about him, although it says he is a member of the Sioux Falls, South Dakota network. So perhaps he lives in Sioux Falls. Anyway, Jason, nice work for guessing that I, Jeff Horwich, am 5'7". Lowly 5'7". It's not that short, is it? And after all these years of hanging upside down and tying weights to my wrists, I'm finally at peace with it. That'll do it for the podcast. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Tell all your friends, leave us some nice reviews on iTunes and Facebook and such. Forward the videos around, everybody you know. You live in the 21st century, you know how it works.
and get in on the action. Check out what we're asking about on our email list and on Facebook and stuff, and let us know what you're thinking. Love to get as many of you on the show as we can. I'm Jeff Horwich, and I will talk to you the next time my tall voice and I sit down in this booth and hit record.